this American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Did you write the book of love, and do you
have... Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Hedrick Smith, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, best-selling author, and Emmy Award-winning producer. His books, The Russians and The Power Game, were critically acclaimed bestsellers. And as a reporter at The New York Times, he shared a Pulitzer for the Pentagon Papers series and won a Pulitzer for his international reporting from Russia in 1971 to 1974. His primetime specials for PBS have won several awards for examining systemic problems in modern America and offering insightful prescriptive solutions. He's the author of the new book, just out, Who Stole the American Dream? Welcome to Background Briefing, Hedrick Smith.
Ian, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And obviously, a lot of people are thinking now about, particularly on the one-year anniversary of Zuccotti Park, about what's happened in America to counter the obvious capture of our politics by an oligarchy and the extent to which our economy has become a plutonomy. Mm-hmm. That seems to be, at least in terms of the Occupy movement, who've coined the phrase the 99% versus the 1%, seems to be the main contribution so far. But reading your book, Who Stole the American Dream, we are, what can I say, we're screwed.
Well, you know, I partly we're screwed because I think fundamentally people don't really understand, maybe some folks do, but not many, really understand the causes of our problems. There's a lot of talk about how you can't raise taxes because that'll hurt the job creators, and that doesn't happen to be right. The job creators are really the middle class, and the middle class have been cut out of their share of the earnings, the growth, the productivity of America. And I started out with the recognition that the middle class was in trouble. In fact, this isn't the book I started out to write. I got into this book when I dug into it and found out what was really going on. I was really interested in how we went from being a pretty effective middle class society, middle class prosperity, middle class political power, an effective bipartisan politics, and now we have polarized, partisan politics, a starkly unequal democracy. That's what you just called the oligarchy, and gaping inequalities in the economy and the middle class stuck in the mud. And I was really trying to understand. I got into the housing crisis and I saw the transfer of $6 trillion of wealth from homeowners to banks before the bubble burst. And I saw the upside down mortgages. And then I looked at the offshoring. And then I looked at companies saying we can't afford to pay workers more. And then I began to see Germany's paying workers more. Daimler-Benz and BMW and Siemens, they're paying workers more. In fact, pay has gone up in Germany. Average worker pay has gone up in Germany 5 times faster in the last 25 years than in America. So that's not really right. And furthermore, the way you said we can't fight the Chinese and the Indians and the Asian tigers, well, the Germans over the last decade had $2 trillion in trade surpluses while we had $6 trillion in trade deficits. So that's not, if it's higher wages and market forces and globalization and technology, then how come we've got such a different reaction and a different result over there? And then you'll look at their economy, 21% of their workers are still in manufacturing. We're told we've got to become a service economy. We have 9% of our workers in manufacturing. Well, manufacturing jobs are the backbone of the middle class. It's not just the manufacturing jobs. It's all the suppliers, all the designers, all the service people that support that. So I began to say, wait a second, the story we're getting here doesn't ring true. We're being told things have to be the way they are. This is the way the market economy works. And we're not getting at the real causes. And the causes were the power shift and wedge economics.
Well, let's just touch on what you brought up about Germany. I've always found it incredibly ironic that the working conditions in Germany that you refer to, and by the way, half of the boards of directors of big German companies are members of the unions, right. All of those changes were mandated by the Marshall Plan. So ironically, in order to stop the flow of communism to the West in Europe, we set up social democracies in Europe that have a high standard of living and better conditions than we've given for our own workers, most obvious of which is healthcare. So do we need a communist threat here in the United States?
Well, I don't think we need a communist threat. I think we've had a pretty bad threat of our own. I think we've generated ourselves. We're at a point where we, the people, should be starting to demand something differently and do it in a coordinated way. You mentioned Occupy. There's no question that the Occupy movement, starting a year ago, changed the dialogue in America. I mean, you can say 1% and 99% today, and everybody knows what you're talking about, and it's thanks to Occupy. But I don't think that Occupy really compares to Martin Luther King's leading the civil rights movement or the movement that pushed all the legislation through on the environment, the Green Movement of the 1970s, or even the women's movement or the consumer movement. Those were all movements which had rather clearly articulated short list of goals. They had leaders who were going to have a sustained drive. And they were able not only to tap the energies and the courage and the risk willingness of the young, but also to draw in the support of the doctors and the lawyers and the professional people in America, so that you had a movement in each of those cases that had a broad base, had real political thrust, and political Washington could not afford to ignore it. I mean, Richard Nixon was no tree-hugging environmentalist, and yet he created the Environmental Protection Agency. He signed a whole lot of that legislation. He created a whole bunch of regulatory boards, because even though he was a buddy of the CEOs and he loved to hobnob with them at Bohemian Grove or wherever, he also recognized that you have to curb the excesses of capitalism in order to make it work for more people.
Well, you've made the point in your new book, Hedrick Smith, Who Stole the American Dream? The Shift in the Money. In the great era of middle-class power and prosperity, average Americans shared fully in the country's economic gains. From 1948 to 1973, productivity rose 96.8%, and the hourly compensation for the average worker went up 93.7%. No more. Since 1973, productivity has risen 80%, and the hourly compensation went up only 10%. So there it is in stark black and white.
That's what I call wedge economics. That's the wedge that is driven between the performance of the economy as a whole, the companies themselves, and the payoff for ordinary people and workers.
Right. In other words, capital has been the beneficiary of increased productivity, and labor has either suffered or been stagnant.
Absolutely. No question about it.
And this gets to the financialization of our economy, where Wall Street continues to dominate it. And I don't understand the culture amongst American CEOs that honestly believe that they deserve this extraordinary disparity in wealth. CEOs are in this stock buyback racket that's driving up the price of stock and driving up their compensation. They're sitting on tons of cash. The economy is stagnant. They're doing great. The rest of us are stuck in the mud, as you've said. And after all, we're the ones that bailed them out. It really sticks in your craw.
Well, you know, I don't think there's any question about that. When I talk to people in bookstores, the angst and the anger comes percolating up right out of those folding chairs. Just one example, and you're talking about financialization. Here we just had this bailout of the big banks to the tune of $700 billion. And yet those banks have now bounced back. They've got profits again, and all those big CEO bonuses are now in effect again. And yet those banks will not turn around and bail out the 20 million American homeowners who are religiously paying their mortgages. These are not people who are welching on their mortgages. This is the foreclosure crowd, and we could talk about them as well. These are people who are paying, but they got stuck in the bubble era with loans with 8.5%, 9%, maybe even more interest rate than that. And if they could refinance today, they'd refinance at 3.5% or 4%. Now, the banks would lose some profit, but after all, the banks are benefiting from taxpayer bailouts, so then maybe they should surrender some profit and get these people out of a hole. It would not only get the people out of a hole who own the homes, it would get the economy out of the hole. Because if those people save $500, $600 or $1,000 a month by paying a lower interest rate on their mortgages, they're going to turn around and turn that into consumer spending. And that's exactly what this economy needs now. It needs consumer spending to drive it. Then those companies wouldn't be sitting on all those billions of dollars of capital and buying back their stock. They would be expanding plant and equipment. We'd be regenerating jobs at home. So there are a bunch of things we could do like that. I mean, at the moment, we got a tax system that gives a buy to General Electric and IBM and big multinationals. When they move jobs overseas, they don't have to pay taxes on their overseas profits. They make the profits. They build more overseas plants. Companies that operate here, trucking companies, hotel companies, restaurants, Costco, you name it, they've got to pay the full tax rate here. It's crazy. We are actually pushing companies to go overseas. That's a fairly simple issue. People can understand it. And if people think that by voting in November they're going to settle that issue, I think they're kidding themselves. I don't think elections themselves decide things. What's really striking about the era of middle-class power and prosperity is people went out in the streets and they demonstrated to make darn sure that Washington did what they wanted them to. We can read poll after poll today. 80% of the people want lobbyists curbed. 67% of the people want the taxes increased on the top 1 or 2% or people who make more than $1 million. But issue after issue, you can see where the public stands and the Congress ignores it. Why do they ignore it? A, because there's no public pressure on the other side, and B, because the lobbyists for the rich and the corporations are so powerful. The spending on lobbying in Washington is so lopsided, I couldn't believe it when I got the numbers from the Center for Responsive Politics. What do you figure? Business outspends labor of what? 2 to 1, 3 to 1, 4 to 1, 8 to 1? No, 65 to 1. In the 2010 congressional campaign, business outspent labor, what, 2 to 1, 5 to 1? No, 16 to 1. And it's probably going to be worse in this campaign.
Right.
I mean, I don't think people sense the situation, but I don't think they grasp just how bad it is. When you look at the facts, I think they're very disturbing. And my hope is that anger can at some point become a politically useful emotion. We can translate it into some kind of political action.
Well, it seems, though, Hedrick Smith, that what's implied here is that if you go back to the foundation of the American dream in the post-war era, we mentioned the Marshall Plan, where we gave the dream to the Europeans,
right,
but
absolutely
withheld a big part of it for ourselves. The great movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, tells that story, I think, in a wonderful metaphoric way. There was a powerful labor movement. Again, when I'm saying, you know, I made the joke that we need the communists to come back to make our capitalists
sure
give us a fair deal.
Sure.
It was the existence, I think, of a powerful labor movement that increased the
no question about
the middle class and the standard of living of Americans. So it's the fact that the playing field isn't in no way level anymore. And I'm wondering if we can engender a form of new capitalist patriotism. Is there a way to name and shame these CEOs who park their profits abroad? Is there a way to name and shame? I noticed the other day that the former head of IBM castigated a lot of his fellow CEOs as being incredibly dumb, and yet they get the huge compensation no matter what dumb decisions they made. It's an amazing double standard that CEOs can get away with incredible incompetence and get an extraordinary compensation, but the average person is really scrambling.
No question about it. No question about it. It was interesting to me is one of the chapters in this book I'm talking about how the banking system got the leverage that they have today, leverage on policy. By the way, interesting, before I go on to the point I was going to make, we all remember that Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve, came out of Wall Street. And we remember that Bob Rubin was the Secretary of Treasury under Clinton, came out of Wall Street. And the same thing with Henry Paulson for George W. Bush. The three chiefs of staff that Barack Obama's had all have roots in Wall Street. Rahm Emanuel made about $18 million on Wall Street before he became chief of staff. Bill Daley came directly from J.P. Morgan, and now Jack Lew, he also worked on Wall Street. So it's not as if, I mean, Wall Street's got its arm into both parties. We need to understand that. That's why I think that this idea of a citizen's rebellion is important. The vote one way or another does make a difference. I don't want to suggest it doesn't. I'm not here to endorse one candidate or another. I'm here to discuss the historical roots of our problems, but I'm also here to discuss what is realistic in practical terms. And I have to tell you, I have plenty of people say to me, oh, Rick, you're crazy. You think people are going to go out and march. You think that's going to happen. You're not very realistic. And I say, my response is, I don't believe that just voting in the right guys, if you can do that, and that may not happen, and the power is going to be split anyway, that just voting in the right guys is going to make it happen. You got to stand there with your hand right behind their back and push them and make sure they keep moving in the right direction. There's no question about it. So a strong labor movement was at the absolute heart of that. The whole middle class standard of living for lots of people who work for non-union companies was built around what they called the Treaty of Detroit, which was the deal between the General Motors and the United Auto Workers in 1948, which guaranteed steady jobs, rising wages, health benefits, and a monthly retirement check. We've gone the other way now. We've gone the way of Sam Walton at Walmart. Low wages, part-time jobs, reduced health benefits, and don't pay any lifetime pension. No wonder the middle class is in a jam.
Now, you make the point in your book that the difference between the corporate culture of Walmart that you just mentioned and Costco where in Walmart, and by the way, the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, own the equivalent wealth of 40% of all Americans on the lower end of the economic scale.
So
the bottom 40% of the entire population of the United States have the equivalent wealth of those five, I think, heirs.
Yeah, and they've been paying the people who have been working for them to build up that wealth very poorly. That's one reason how it got so lopsided. I mean, literally, directly the people in Walmart.
Right. So give us a sense of the difference here with Costco. In other words, it's possible to run a company in the way that companies used to be run in the 40s and 50s or up until the 70s.
Yeah. This is the big change in the business ethos, the business mindset that occurred. Even the guys that ran Standard Oil of New Jersey, General Electric, General Motors, they believed that the job of the CEO was to take care of and listen to the work, to take care of all the stakeholders, all the parties that had a stake in the success of the corporation, the owners, the shareholders, the workers, the suppliers, the communities they operated in, and the customers. So the job of the CEO was to balance all that. That went out in the 80s, and we came up basically with this Walmart model. But it's interesting. People say today you can't operate the way you operated back in the 60s and 70s. The world has changed. It doesn't work that way. The only way you can survive is to cut to the bone and so forth. Well, talk to Jim Sinegal. Jim Sinegal has been the CEO of Costco for a very long time. Right? Costco and Walmart are in the same ballgame. I did a documentary for PBS quite a while ago called Is Walmart Good for America? And that acquainted me quite a bit with Walmart. And at the time, Walmart was paying terrible health insurance premiums. They weren't paying very much for their employees at all. They were letting them live off the Medicaid or live off their spouse's health care. But they got shamed into raising their health care benefits for their employees, and they did a bit better. And then in 2011, they announced they couldn't do it anymore. They couldn't afford it. They had to cut back. And they were very sorry, but those are the realities. Jim Sinegal at Costco said, no, we have to provide health care for our workers. We have an obligation to them. We have an obligation to the communities they live in and work in. We can't dump our health problems of our employees on the public health system. We can do that. Now, what's interesting is the CEOs of Walmart were making about $20 million a year, and the Walmart family was clipping all those coupons and piling up all those billions. Jim Sinegal was making $2 million a year as a CEO. He thought that was adequate. He had some stock. He did make some gains. He's not a guy who's poorly off, but he was not a guy who had to go bananas. I mean, we are looking at greed. I mean, I think some of this actually is personal insecurity. I've been scratching my head to try to figure out what makes CEOs, what makes some people on Wall Street work the way they are. And I conclude they have enormous insecurity. They've confused net worth with net worth. They think if they're worth more, if they can go from $3 billion net worth to $4 billion net worth, they're somehow better human beings. And there's no connection. And there's no end to it. There's no bottom to it. And if that's the way they want to live, then we should tax those stock options that they're making money on at a much higher rate. We should have a special rate. We should certainly raise the capital gains tax rate, which is pure and simply puts the earnings of the rich at a lower tax rate than ordinary people. What's interesting is the payroll tax, basic element of supporting Social Security and Medicare, while the top tax rate was going down from 92% under Eisenhower to 35% under George W. Bush, the payroll tax rate was going up from 3.5% to 7.65%. It was being doubled. So the tax that everybody, every ordinary person has to pay has been doubled, and the tax that people at the top have to pay has been coming down. And then if you go to people who are making $10, $20 million now, they're not subject to payroll tax on all that money above $106,000. So they're paying a payroll tax of 1%, 1/10 of 1%, maybe 1/100th of 1%, while the average worker is paying 7.65%. That's crazy. It's a crazy system. I mean, no rational person sitting down looking at it, even wealthy people, would never say, well, that was a sensible system. Right. They might defend it so they could hang on to more of their money, but they could hardly call it a rational system.
Let's just try and end on a positive note here, because my understanding is that we don't have to accept the inevitability of the complete financialization of our economy and the capture of our politics by Wall Street. For example, community banks are starting to spread in North Dakota. They're, in fact, starting to happen there. There's also community utilities are starting to happen more. For example, in the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has the best broadband in the world. They have high-speed internet access for all citizens in that community. So that's just an example of how communities can just go their own way. You contrast Chattanooga's high-speed internet with the city of Birmingham, Alabama, that made the mistake of turning to Wall Street, and guess what? They're bankrupt.
Mm. So, I mean, there are hopeful signs. I mean, even in the recovery of General Motors and Chrysler is not only a victory for a bailout that was absolutely necessary, but it has now led to better cooperation between management and the union in both of those companies to actually bring plants back from Mexico and so forth. They're working hand in hand. That's the way it used to be. Even when they struggled at negotiation time, they worked together. We've gotten in this sort of divisive, nasty, mean, all for me kind of a mood. And it's destructive not only to individuals, but it's destructive to our whole economy. And it has, as I said, stolen the American dream.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Hedrick Smith.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, bestselling author, and Emmy Award winning producer. His books, The Russians and the Power Game, were critically acclaimed bestsellers. And as a reporter at the New York Times, he shared a Pulitzer for the Pentagon Papers series and won a Pulitzer for his international reporting from Russia in 1971 to 1974. His primetime specials for PBS have won several awards for examining systemic problems in modern America and offering insightful prescriptive solutions. He's the author of the new book, just out, Who Stole the American Dream? And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.